You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 18th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Henry Grabar, author of Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. And later in the show, Marilyn Thompson, reporter at ProPublica, on Jim Clyburn's role in racial gerrymandering in his state. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, Dianne Feinstein's caregiver. Yes. Nothing to see there except them probably trying to box out Barbara.
Some of our faves might be Weekend at Bernie people and before Adam Schiff.
That's not my favorite Nancy Pelosi daughter. My favorite's the documentary filmmaker. More on that later. A new Fifth Circuit judge panel heard arguments banning mifepristone again. The Supreme Court lets Illinois keep its semi-automatic weapons ban in place. This comes as a University of Chicago study shows trust in the Supreme Court is at its lowest in 50 years. Ron DeSantis is expected to officially enter the presidential race next week. It's about time.
Only can go up from here.
Right. This is after he just signed an anti-trans bill into law that would allow Florida to kidnap children receiving gender-affirming care. Texas officially bans trans-affirming care for children as well. And South Carolina passes a six-week abortion ban. These state legislatures are just churning this crap out here. Speaking of crap, Montana passes a TikTok ban, which is just stupid. Dancers at an L.A. strip bar in North Hollywood have unionized, the first stripper union in the country. Woohoo! Deutsche Bank will pay $75 million to Jeffrey Epstein's victims. And lastly, an 8-year-old girl dies while in U.S. Border Patrol custody yesterday. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, everybody. How the hell are ya? I am back from my vacation.
Welcome back, Emma.
Yes, I saw Sam was repeatedly saying I was at a wedding. No.
Sorry, I didn't really have the heart to correct him.
He would have made the same mistake the next day. Not that it matters, but this is the bachelorette party before the big wedding. This is my best friend in the whole world. So we went out to California with a little group, did some hiking, sat in the sun, felt pretty nice. And then I stayed a little bit later and saw some friends in L.A. So it was fun. I was rooming with a girl that had a cold, and so now I have that cold. But other than that, honestly, pretty relaxing vacation. Good to get out of the city. How were things here, everybody?
Actually, better than ever. I think we had maybe our best week.
Yeah, it's just numbers through the roof.
Wow! All right. So all those debt ceiling talks, he just killed
really
it.
Fun, yeah.
Yeah. As soon as they got the nag out of the studio, You know, everyone wants to listen to political commentary again. All right. Well,
a bit looser lately.
Yeah, you guys could just really like say what you wanted about
the locker room talk.
A little bit of locker room
it
talk.
It was the boys' chat.
Totally. So yeah, while I was doing painting nails with girls, you guys were farting or something. I don't really know.
Belly bumping.
But missed you all. Hello to everybody. And excited to be back. Honestly. Let's touch on this before we get to our first guest, Henry, here, because I'm not trying to take a little victory lap, but I've been pushing this theory. Well, yes, I am. I've been pushing this theory for a while. And when there is something in Politico, it essentially means that there's a party that wants it out there. It's a glorified gossip rag. That doesn't mean that what it prints is wrong. It just means it always has an agenda.
Right.
And especially when you're in the midst of things like debt ceiling negotiations and legislative fights, you have to be very wary about taking whatever is reported
exactly
in this publication as fact.
Political editors don't wake up saying, like, what's the most true thing we can emphasize today?
It's, yeah.
Who can we service of our sources?
Right. Especially for this kind of, it's not right. ProPublica is doing deep investigative work. That's very different than what Politico is doing, frankly, here. They're speaking to sources, and some source, at least in the Pelosi camp, wants this out there, which is fascinating. Because let's pull this this article up here. Didn't see this twist coming. Nancy Pelosi's daughter is the aide to Dianne Feinstein, who returned last week to the Senate with a lot of fanfare, looking not so hot. And amid rampant speculation that she is suffering from dementia, a Slate reporter spoke to her. She didn't even remember or seem to remember her 2.5-month-long absence from the Senate.
Yeah, it's confirmed.
Yeah, it's confirmed. I'm being very generous with this. But didn't see this twist coming here, that Nancy Corinne Prouda, she blended into the swarm around the legendary California Democrat. The San Francisco Chronicle made note of her presence, but left unnoticed amid the spectacle was the larger role that Prouda, the eldest child of former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, has come to play in Feinstein's life as an 89-year-old, has dealt with the absence of her deceased husband, the departure of trusted staffers, a nasty case of shingles and spiraling concerns about her fitness for office. I mean, that's some pretty kind framing there. But the headline is that Nancy Pelosi's daughter is the aide of Dianne Feinstein?
This paragraph, by all accounts, the arrangement is rooted in long and friendly relationship between Feinstein and the Pelosi's, two pillars of San Francisco politics. And I'll just remind people what Pelosi was saying that I appreciate AOC standing up against, which is Pelosi says, I don't understand where all these questions were. I don't remember these sorts of questions about a man, which is just factually like there is absolutely precedent for people having concerns about our elderly representatives having these sorts of issues, and a party needs to be able to deal with it instead of hiding behind faux feminism.
There's concern about Biden. Let's be real. Absolutely. There's concern about the president. There was concern about Reagan. Strom Thurmond had to be wheeled onto the Senate floor to have votes. There was concern about Chuck Grassley, you know, years ago when he's tweeting about pigeons in his backyard. Like,
yeah,
this
Leslie
is nothing Stahl new.
In like the 86 said like she was interviewing Reagan and it's like he wasn't even there.
I mean, and that's where we're at right now with Feinstein. But everyone's pretending that to question it is some violation of a girl boss ethic or something like
it's
that.
It's a debasement of feminism. Like,
of course.
That is horrible. Like, it's own sin that she did that.
But they'll go to any length to debase feminism. They did that with Hillary Clinton. That was the entirety of her presidential campaign. Don't question all of these things about this immensely kind of corrupt Democrat, because that's a violation of feminism. But let's pull the article back up. Because when they say that, this is what they're hiding. By all accounts, Matt just read that part, but here's the real kicker. And this is where I was fascinated to see this be a little bit more confirmed after I'd been speculating for a while. The intrigue surrounds the future of Feinstein's seat. Pelosi has endorsed Representative Adam Schiff, her longtime protege and former hand-picked House Intelligence Committee chair, to succeed Feinstein after her sixth and final term ends next year.
Sus.
Schiff is a household name in California and already has a $15 million campaign cash advantage over her nearest competitor. But if Feinstein were to bow to pressure and retire early, Schiff's advantage could disappear. Governor Gavin Newsom has pledged to appoint a black woman to serve out her term, and one of Schiff's declared opponents, Representative Barbara Lee, would fit the bill. If DiFi resigns right now, there's an enormous possibility that Barbara Lee gets appointed. Thus, it makes it harder for Schiff, one Pelosi confidant told Playbook, adding that the relationship between Pelosi, her daughter, and the senator is, quote, being kept under wraps, and very closely held.
Sick.
Although there's a Pelosi family confidant who's speaking to Politico, thankfully, about this. So this confirms what I had thought before, and I'd heard rumblings about, and this was very credible, in my opinion.
Unbelievable.
That they are trying to box out Barbara Lee.
For Adam Schiff.
For Adam Schiff. Well, I mean, but this is how Pelosi does politics. She has been grooming Adam Schiff to be one of the leaders in the Democratic Party once she retires.
Yeah,
and
to
in the same way she was doing with Hakeem Jeffries.
Right. Which is to say, like, Generation X custodians of the skeletons in the closet.
Yeah. And I mean, and by far, Adam Schiff is the worst of the three options in terms of progressivism who are purportedly running for that seat in California. My sense is that there is probably some half-stepping on the part of Barbara Lee's campaign, and that I think she's launching this campaign to pressure the likes of Newsom to appoint her, because there's a sense that maybe she wouldn't spend a ton of time as the senator from California since she's in her 70s as well. However, that's what this really is boiling down to. As they do the girl boss stuff, as they pretend like it's completely rude of us to say that in one of the most important Senate seats in the country, 100 most powerful people, let alone her seniority on the Judiciary Committee as we deal with the Supreme Court legitimacy crisis and multiple extremist right-wing challenges in the court system, that getting her out is a priority, and they say that that's anti-feminist in some way, just know that they're completely lying to you. Yeah. They're completely lying, because behind the scenes, it's all about trying to stomp out the prospects of two women, Katie Porter and Barbara Lee more specifically, trying to run for this seat in California. I mean, the problem for Newsom, and maybe Newsom's working with Pelosi on this, is that Newsom got some crap for appointing Padilla to Kamala Harris's seat when she became vice president. He had previously said that he was going to appoint a black woman. I don't understand why Democrats box themselves in like this, just appoint the black woman, don't pre-announce it. It also undercuts them a little bit. I mean, Biden made that mistake with Ketanji Brown Jackson as well, in my opinion. But either way, he now feels essentially that he should be appointing a black woman to, if Feinstein does retire. And just based on Barbara Lee's service to the Democratic Party in that state, I mean, she endorsed Kamala Harris instead of Bernie Sanders last election cycle. She's played the game, despite being more progressive than a lot of them. So she's the natural choice. I think that's why they're so hesitant. They don't want to give her a leg up against Adam Schiff. And if people see her act as senator, they'll get used to her being senator. And it does give her a leg up. That's how this kind of thing works.
Man, I would like to not hear about Adam Schiff anymore.
Well, he's probably going to win. I mean, because like this is the anti-democracy within the structure of the Democratic Party. We saw this on the macro level with Bernie Sanders. They are consistently trying to beat back these kinds of progressives. And there's so much internal pressure, so many backroom deals that we'll never know about that are motivating these decisions. But Nancy Pelosi, despite not being speaker anymore, still very much pulling the strings, making her daughter the puppeteer. That's the person standing beside Pelosi here, probably making a lot of these decisions. It's Nancy Pelosi through her daughter acting as a shadow senator for Feinstein.
Yes.
I mean, that's crazy.
That's what is happening.
Anyway. Just when we thought she was out, she's back in.
Now she's in the Senate by proxy.
Somehow. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Henry Grabar.
We'll be right back.
We are back, and we are joined now by Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate and author of Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. Henry, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So on the show before, we've spoken a lot about the disaster that is our country's obsession with cars and how all of our public infrastructure is seemingly designed to accommodate the car. At the expense of things like public transport. But there's so many other wrinkles to this that your book explores. I'll ask you this question first. Why do we have a country built to accommodate the car if we can never find any damn parking anywhere? It doesn't make any sense. And the fact that, as you write, so much of our spaces are designated to literal parking lots and garages and things like that.
Yeah, I think the dream of free and easy parking has motivated a lot of very bad urban design decisions over the course of the 20th century. And, you know, I get it. Everybody who drives obviously needs and wants a perfect place to park. Like, parking people explain this by saying that people want parking to be free. They want it to be convenient, which is to say right in front of where they're going. And they want it to be available, which is to say open the moment they arrive. And it turns out that fulfilling all three of those qualities is extremely difficult because parking takes up a lot of space and it costs a lot of money to build. So so achieving all three of those things turns out to be sort of impossible in any thriving place. And if you do manage to ensure that triple threat parking for anybody who wants it, you're going to end up with an urban environment that looks like your classic sprawling suburb with where the parking lots are larger than the buildings.
So I just got back from Los Angeles yesterday. I live here in Brooklyn. Those two areas of the country seem to have very unique problems with parking and cars that are quite different. I mean, what are the kind of identifiable problems in urban spaces like that when it comes to sprawl or private parking, things like that?
I think that most cities where it's tough to find parking have three common problems. The first is that parking is underpriced. Just say if you provide free parking in a location where everybody wants to park, like say on a busy commercial strip or residential street in Park Slope, you're going to force a lot of people. You're going to create an incentive for people to leave their cars there for a long, long time. And rather than, for example, parking them in garages or even at out-of-the-way spots. So when you underprice parking at attractive destinations, you create a localized supply and demand problem, or which is to say a supply shortage. And that has a lot of negative externalities. People driving a lot looking for parking, which adds literally millions of miles on the road just in a single neighborhood. Every year. So it's a massive contributor to traffic congestion, greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. And that's all because the parking is improperly priced. The second thing I'd say about that is that often the parking isn't shared. And so you get, like, you see this lot in Los Angeles where you'll have a lot that is proprietary, that belongs to a particular business or a particular residential building that can't be used by anybody else. And what this adds up to is an environment where there is a lot of parking, but it's not always accessible. You when you need a place to park. And that's a really common problem. We don't share parking in this country. And that's another reason that there may be a lot of it, but it also feels difficult to park. And then the last one is that parking is hard to find. And it's, what you can look for, like Google Maps will tell you how long it's going to take you to drive just about anywhere. And it'll be accurate down to a couple minutes. But there is no solution for parking, right? Like it remains this kind of opaque and unexplored terrain where local know-how is prized above all else. And I get it. Like I also love being able to know exactly where the best free parking is in my neighborhood too. But if you're running like a city, you don't really want every visitor to be dependent on that type of local knowledge to know where to leave their car.
Well, you want to try to incentivize at least some sort of public transit usage for people that are essentially touring the city. Right. Like, what we talk increasingly about the urban centers becoming kind of playgrounds for wealthy people who want to visit for the day. We talked about this in the context of the Jordan Neely story, in the context of how San Francisco is kind of constructed. And that's part of it too, right? Creating parking tourism or parking for tourism as opposed to parking for the people that live in these urban centers.
One of the problems with this system of the a private lot associated with every home or business is that if you want to drive somewhere, you are unable to execute what is called a park once strategy, right? Like ideally, we would want you to be able to park your car, leave it there for 4 or 5 hours, and then do the rest of your travel on foot, right? And go to a restaurant, go to a shop, you know, take your kid to a music lesson, all that stuff. And that becomes impossible when every place you park is proprietary and belongs to the business where you've parked at, right? Because then you have to keep moving your car every time. So that's definitely bad. The other thing about parking is that if you're trying to get people on transit, for example, the number one determinant of whether people will drive is whether they have a place to park. It's like more than anything else. And this is true of parking at home. It's true of parking at the office. It's true of easy free parking in urban neighborhoods. If you build it, they will come in their cars.
So what time period in the 20th century do you think that this parking lot obsession really started to gain steam and hit its fever pitch? How did it start like this?
Well, pretty much as soon as Americans started buying automobiles. I mean, the Model T comes out in 1908, and quickly people realize that because, unlike horses, cars can be stored all night, all week, all month outside. There's going to be a major problem with people leaving their automobiles everywhere. And so the first half of the 20th century, American cities begin to confront this really disastrous traffic problem, which experts think is caused by people looking for parking. Because you get downtown, there's no place to park, and you either circle and circle and circle trying to find a place to park, or you just give up and you double park, in which case you are causing traffic congestion behind the place that you chose to leave your car. And then in the 1940s and 50s, cities come up with a solution. And they say, not only are we going to build some parking ourselves, but we're going to require every single property owner to include a certain amount of parking, depending on what type of land use it is. So a restaurant needs to have a certain number of spots, and a home needs to have a certain number of spots, and an office building needs to have a certain number of spots. And so those laws didn't have an immediate effect because they didn't require it of every building on the spot. But every time a building was renovated, turned over to a new use, and obviously every time something was built new, it was required to come with an enormous amount of parking. That parking was built to suburban standards, and it ensured that for 60, 70 years, and in most cities and suburbs still today, building to a suburban standard of parking that assumes that everyone will be driving to and from your location is a requirement, and that is baked into the way we build things today. And that's the cause of a lot of the architecture and urbanism you see in this country today.
I mean, and can you give some examples of different areas and cities in which this kind of made its effects felt most acutely?
I think one of the most famous examples is Marina City in Chicago, which is the sort of corncob towers made famous, at least to me personally, because they were on the cover of Wilco's album, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And those buildings are like parking up to here and then apartments above like that. And that's called a parking podium building. And if you go to any American downtown, I was just in downtown Cincinnati yesterday, and you will see this is like pretty typical of the post-war urban forum. The buildings will have garages on floors 1 through 10 or 12, and then they'll have office or residential above that. So that's one example of how parking has worked its way into the architecture. Another one that is perhaps more consequential is with housing, right? Like if you want to build an apartment building, most places you're required to include 1 to 2, sometimes more, parking spots with every new unit. And again, that not only has an impact on the urban forum and on our transportation choices and on architecture, but it also costs a lot of money. Mm. Parking, structured parking, can be $30,000, $50,000, $70,000 a stall. And if you're trying to build low-income housing, that becomes a massive cost center for your project and can reduce the number of units you're able to build at the end of the day.
So yeah, can you expand on that point, particularly about how parking has driven up rental prices broadly throughout the country and contributed to a lack of affordable housing in a lot of these areas?
Yeah, I think there's two things happening. I mean, number one, building parking costs a lot of money, and in most places it's required. And so the studies I've seen, like Seattle did a study showing that parking contributed 10 to 20% of the rent in new multifamily buildings. And so if you don't own a car, that's a lot of money you're paying just right off the bat for a useless garage space. And it's not like they'll let you store your furniture there or something. It has to be used for cars. It's like one function only. Other studies, California and Arizona, there was a federal study of low-income housing there that found structured parking added $70,000 onto the cost of every new unit, and so on, you know, on and on and on. And obviously, this isn't just a problem once the projects get built. It also prevents a lot of stuff from getting built in the first place. Like, let's say you want to build a row of brownstones like you have in Brooklyn, or a triple decker, or a three flat like in Chicago, or a bungalow court in LA, like all these forms of early 20th century vernacular architecture, which are in many cases some of our most beloved housing typologies today, are impossible to build because they don't have enough parking. So there, it's not even a question of cost. It's just like, it's not going to happen. I mean, like maybe you could build a gigantic underground garage underneath your row of brownstones, but again, you're going to pay out the nose for it and you're going to wind up with purely luxury housing typology. And people aren't going to want to park down there anyway because everybody prefers to park at the curb. So this is a big problem. And then the second thing I'll say about this is that people, neighbors are so concerned about the parking shortage that they reject new housing on the grounds that it's going to challenge their claim to the existing public parking supply. And I think that is a dynamic you see in every city and suburb in the country when a new building is proposed. People view new neighbors as coming in 2,000-pound steel packages, and it leads the way to what we might call NIMBYism, or even more fundamentally, like a kind of Malthusian view about how much room there is in the city, because you're not thinking about room for people, you're thinking about room for cars.
That's interesting. I'd never thought about it that way. I mean, what? How does that in particular? Well, it contributes to NIMBYism, I would guess, broadly. But does it contribute in the specific way that I guess it's targeted towards affordable housing or lower income housing as well?
I mean, you could spend all day trying to parse the motivations of neighbors who get up at the community meeting and say this project doesn't have enough parking, so we need to turn it down and say no. And there are definitely cases. There are stories that I tell in my book where it's very clear that neighbors' motivations aren't entirely about parking. At the same time, I think there's a lot of cases where people genuinely get wound up about their claim to street parking, and they worry that new neighbors are going to take away what they've been given for free because they moved to the neighborhood earlier and they feel they have a claim on that curbside parking. So both those things are happening at once, but I think it's really a major factor, and it's totally unstudied, and it's very hard to come up with firm data on this. But if you've ever been to a city council meeting or a community meeting where a new project is discussed, I guarantee you parking will be top of mind, if not the single dominant concern about from neighbors about what's being proposed.
Can you talk about the example that you gave? It was a bizarre story in Chicago in 2009, where there was a parking meter initiative and Morgan Stanley took it over. This is, I think, feeds really nicely into just the whole issue and discussion around privatization. But this seemed pretty obviously like it would be a disaster from the get-go.
Yeah. So in Chicago in 2000, and starting in 2008, Chicago decided they were going to sell or lease off all their parking meters, 36,000 parking meters, for the next 75 years to a group of Wall Street investors led by the bank Morgan Stanley. And Chicago got $1.15 billion for a 75-year lease on the parking meters, which seemed like a lot of money at the time. And perhaps seems like a lot of money to you when you think about putting quarters in a parking meter. But later studies showed that the city had actually been shorted by as much as $1 billion and perhaps several more. And not only that, not only had they gotten ripped off when they leased off their parking meters, but because they gave away their parking meters, they lost control of their streets. And so every time Chicago wants to build a bike lane or hold a ticker tape parade or close a street for a farmer's market, they have to negotiate with the company that runs the parking meters because they're taking meters out of revenue service and they need to make up for that elsewhere. So it's become a huge problem for Chicago. And I think that what that shows is what this deal shows to me is how little anyone really thinks about parking as a systemic issue in the urban landscape. And that is true also of its effect on housing prices. It's true of its effect on architecture, and it's true of its effect on our transportation choices. And all of these issues to me are knit together by this concept that parking is ignored and mismanaged at our peril.
What was the motivation behind the city making that deal? Was it quick cash from Morgan Stanley? I mean, I guess we're in the midst of the financial collapse at this point.
Right. Yeah. They're staring down the recession and thinking, we can get $1 billion now. Right. And that sounds really great. And whatever the future brings, we'll deal with that when it comes. I think they made two arguments in favor. And one of them, which are common to privatization discussion, one of them was the technical expertise argument, which in this case I find particularly absurd, but it's that, you know, you need to let a private company do this because this public sector doesn't have the wherewithal. And
it's too complicated to understand the whole parking meter system. You could let the experts weigh in here.
You're joking, but yes, that's what they said. And that might be true if you're building a, you know, nuclear power plant or something like that, but not for parking meters. And then the second one, which is even funnier, is that they said, they knew how Morgan Stanley was going to make this money. They knew why the bank thought that the parking meters were worth more than $1 billion. And it's because the bank was planning to immediately triple, and in some cases, even more than that, raise the parking meter rates. But they said, we would never be able to do that because politically it would be too challenging for us. So we'll have to sell them off to Morgan Stanley. They can raise the rates and make money from it, but we as a city council would never be able to achieve that objective.
That is dark. I wanted to ask you about parking and how it interacts with our environment and the environmental crisis. What are some of the effects that these like massive lots and parking allocation, what does that do to our environment?
Yeah, well, I think the most fundamental thing is that parking encourages driving. It is both a subsidy for car ownership and car use, and it creates a ruined urban environment that is low density, dangerous for pedestrians, and poorly served by transit. And so all of those things combine to create huge incentives to drive. Transportation is the country's largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, as well as producing a number of other externalities, such as car crashes, local particulate pollution, et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to go into all that. But parking is the lever to control people's transportation choices. And free parking encourages lots of driving. So that's the first environmental consequence. And then the second one is all of the material that goes into building all this parking. I mean, I talked to a developer in Dallas in the book who's a commercial real estate developer who owns office space. And he was getting fed up with building all these parking garages that were half unused for all his structures, which were required both by local laws and also required by lenders. And he would build all this parking and he would say, like, just think about all the concrete and asphalt and energy that is getting wasted in producing all this parking that is going to sit mostly empty most of the time. And that is the case for parking in this country. I mean, we have 1 to 2 billion parking spaces, and that means we have at least 3 and potentially 6 or 7 for every car. And some of those cars are in motion. So the parking stock is mostly unused, and that's an enormous amount of waste just to have built all that. And then obviously it has a more direct effect on the environment as well, because you are paving over natural land, you are creating impervious surface that floods, sends rainwater and stormwater into the sewers during big rainfall events, and also contributes to the urban heat island. It's just, you know, a parking lot is not obviously a very friendly place for natural life.
Certainly not. I mean, what is, do you see positive developments on this front in terms of new housing maybe being built in cities and them saying these parking requirements that are met, that are assigned to suburban standards that we have to stick with, this is not realistic in this day and age. Are we seeing any progress on that front?
Yeah, I think it has pretty broad cross-political appeal because liberals rightly see these requirements as a subsidy for fossil fuels, a contributor to lots and lots of driving, which has lots of externalities, and also an impediment to building affordable housing. Whereas conservatives, I think, would rightly see them as a kind of needless imposition on what you are free to do with your property. And so these reforms have found a pretty broad success in the last 5 years. There's a group called the Parking Reform Network that is actually made up of people who are obsessed with parking. And they're all over the country and they go to city council meetings and they make these arguments about why we should change the laws in the hopes of, allowing ourselves to provide affordable housing, walkable urbanism, attractive architecture, all these things that have been basically impossible to achieve because of all this parking. And since I started writing this book in 2017, dozens of cities and even a couple states have changed their policy on this issue. So it is happening right now. And I think there's a greater and greater awareness that if your number one concern is traffic, if it's affordable housing, if it's the environment, if it's the architectural quality of your neighborhood, and your number one request is parking, that you have to understand that those things are at cross purposes.
Do you think that the pandemic changed certain attitudes towards this when now we're having a bit of like a realization that the commuting obsession is maybe not as necessary for certain sectors?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things going on. I mean, number one, you're going to have a lot of overbuilt downtown parking and also overbuilt retail parking as e-commerce takes off and begins to replace people driving to the store and leaving their car there. So one more reason to think more flexibly about sharing parking, about building new structures that don't require parking, that can make use of that existing overbuilt stock. The other factor, of course, is the potential problems associated with mass transit losing its downtown office space, right? Like a lot of transit use was subsidized by people going downtown every day. And if we lose that, if we lose that feature and transit systems lose that, lose all those ticket buyers, does that have consequences for people's ability to live a car-free life in and around their neighborhood? So I think we're going to see how that plays out. I mean, for now, I would say in the neighborhoods, I think the development since 2020 has been very positive. There were, you may remember in 2020, there were all these restaurants that decided overnight that this parking that had hitherto been considered an absolutely essential feature of the urban environment and of doing business, don't touch it. We'll go out of business if you take away our parking. All of a sudden they were like, actually we don't need the parking for this. We can just turn it into restaurant seating. And I think that was a phenomenal success and showed people like, it moved the Overton window a little bit in terms of thinking, why have we consigned all this public space just for the storage of automobiles? What if we were to do something else with it? And that doesn't need to be just restaurant seating, of course. I mean, that's only the tip of the iceberg. And I think this is catching on even in places like, again, I was just in Cincinnati, and in the Over the Rhine neighborhood in Cincinnati, there are beautiful parklets that have been formerly parking spaces that have now been converted into public space. And here we are 3 years after. So I think there's a sense of retrenchment and that some of the car-free streets during the pandemic have been rolled back. But I think people's perspective has permanently shifted.
Well, that's a good thing. Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate, author of Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. We'll put a link to your book everywhere you're listening to this or watching this and at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today, Henry. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Marilyn Thompson of ProPublica about Jim Clyburn's role in racial gerrymandering. Be right back. Back, and we are joined now by Marilyn Thompson of ProPublica. She has written one major piece and a follow-up piece as well on Jim Clyburn's role in working with Republicans to dilute black voting power in South Carolina, but to entrench his own power. Marilyn, thank you so much for coming on today to talk about your work in this area.
Thank you.
For sure. So the Supreme Court last week, or 2 weeks ago, I'm not sure, they heard oral arguments on the South Carolina redistricting case. But before we get into Clyburn's role here, talk a bit about what this case is about.
Well, the case was brought by the NAACP, and it alleged that South Carolina's congressional redistricting plan was a racial gerrymander. The original complaint cited a number of different congressional districts where they thought that gerrymandering had occurred illegally. The Republicans contended, of course, that there was no race involved in their decision, that this was all based on partisan politics, which is legal under the Supreme Court rulings. And so, you know, you had a plan that basically had seven congressional districts, which is what South Carolina has, and they were carved up in ways that the NAACP said they deliberately moved black people to limit their political effectiveness.
And with these seven districts, is there now only one district that is majority black, and that is Clyburn's district?
That's correct. Jim Clyburn has held the sixth congressional district since 1992, and he was elected originally after the state legislature, under a court mandate, figured out a way to give blacks in South Carolina a member of Congress. This had not been the case for many, many years, and the black population of South Carolina is substantial, and at that point in time was about a third of the population. So they carved out a district for but won by Jim Clyburn that literally stretched across the state and roped in black communities from Columbia, South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, and everything along the way. That district had a majority black population, and it was the district that ensured that a Democrat, namely Jim Clyburn, could win and stay in office as the state turned increasingly Republican over the years.
So at its outset, Jim Clyburn's seat has been essentially a racially gerrymandered district. And you, for a long time, of course, you could blame the Republicans for that. Look, they're all they're putting the black voters into just Clyburn's district. This is kind of standard practice for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But what's news and what's incredible that you broke over at ProPublica is just how involved it appears to have been Clyburn and his staff has been in maintaining the racial gerrymander that's kept him in power.
Yeah, I found it absolutely fascinating and, you know, went into this not really knowing anything about Clyburn's role in this. I interviewed Congressman Clyburn in his office back in December of last year and asked him some questions about Republicans and what they were saying in South Carolina about how he had interfered in the process. And he got just furious talking about it. So I didn't know where I was going to go as I began looking into the court record. And what I found was fairly shocking to me. The Republican lawmakers who were running the redistricting conferred with Congressman Clyburn's staff. They brought in a map that was drawn to show what he wanted the 6th district to look like. And none of this was ever made publicly available, which is kind of shocking because the redistricting process is supposed to be a public process. They go to great lengths to travel around the state. In this case, they did what they called a roadshow, where lawmakers from these committees went around the state and held public hearings to get input from real people. But what I found was that the real dealing was going on in secret behind the scenes.
So I want to back up to the Supreme Court overturning that part of the Voting Rights Act, which enabled this kind of racial gerrymandering to return in a really big way. I mean, it's always happened, but there's no federal oversight anymore. Did that shift anything in the relationship between Clyburn and some of these Republican lawmakers? Did it make it more shadowy?
Well, it's really interesting. And, you know, I'm not a Supreme Court reporter. And so I followed this developing law from kind of a distance. But, you know, what happened essentially was the court stepped in on some cases in other states and scaled back the protections of the Voting Rights Act in states like South Carolina. South Carolina, for the first time in 2021, did not have to submit any of its plans to the Justice Department to get pre-approval. And this is a big, big change in a state that has had a long history of racial discrimination and voting rights violations. So it was a new landscape. The legislature was on its own. They were free to pass whatever plan they wanted. But the Republicans were being very, very careful here because they did not want to be sued, as they ultimately were, on a racial gerrymandering claim. And so they deferred to Jim Clyburn. They testified in court that when Clyburn sent in his map and his special request, they bent over backwards to try to accommodate those. So, you know, it's a really changing landscape. Developing law as the Supreme Court hears these redistricting cases. And the fact that they're now going to hear a 3-judge panel's decision in the South Carolina case is really fascinating because it will help define the limits of racial gerrymandering and when a legislature has overstepped the law.
Is Clyburn's involvement being used in, I guess, the plaintiff's favor as a way to undercut the racism accusations?
Yes, that's what happened before the 3-judge panel. And as I dug into the court record, I was really stunned by that. The legislators, the Republican legislators, were represented by a very eminent lawyer here in Washington, John Gore. He led the legal team. And as the case developed, the Republicans kept making the point. Jim Clyburn submitted his map, Jim Clyburn wanted these things. And it did create a very, you know, finger-pointing way of accusing Clyburn of being part of the problem. At the NAACP, I interviewed them for my piece, and they clearly think that this is a case of Republicans trying to blame a black elected official when they were, in fact, the one with racist intent.
Yes, his intent was just, and I'm editorializing here, just a careerist, which, I mean...
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was really interesting to me to talk to people emerging in the South Carolina Democratic Party as potential candidates, because there's a very different generational vibe that you get here. Clyburn's generation and others who were, you know, coming up during the Voting Rights Act, they enjoyed those protections. And they tried very hard to keep their districts majority black. The new generation of black leader, and I quoted a guy named Bakari Sellers, that he's widely believed to be a contender for Clyburn's seat when and if the congressman decides to step down. But Mr. Sellers' view is you don't need 50+% blacks to win these days. And so spread out the black Democrats. Let other congressional districts have part of that dedicated Democratic vote. And that way you create more of a likelihood that you'll have more representation.
Mm. I mean, that's also just, that's more Democratic, right? As opposed to being, I guess, in the interests that Sellers is contending there of the Democrats in the state, it's also just the right thing to do and what the party is supposedly in favor of. But it's just, I think the implications are so important of this being Clyburn who's involved in this, given his stature within the Democratic Party and the fact that he's the head of the Congressional Black Caucus. Can you talk about that angle to it? And the Congressional Black Caucus's importance in this particular debate and discussion?
Yeah, I mean, the views of the Black Caucus have also evolved. Congressman Clyburn was the head of the Black Caucus years ago, you know, back when majority black districts were the fight. That's what they were trying to create all across America. And as a result of that, the Black Caucus was able to amass greater numbers and more influence in the Congress. But those times have changed. And when you have a congressman like Jim Clyburn, who literally is, you know, he's one of the most famous people in South Carolina, who has a following across the state, both black and white, you have to wonder, does he need 52% blacks in his district, or could he win with less?
Right.
And everybody believes he could win with less. I interviewed one of his friends from the old days, a congressman, former congressman in North Carolina, Mel Watt, fascinating guy. He said Jim Clyburn could win with 20% black votes. So, you know, it's a changing dynamic. And as you said, it's one of the critical questions about how we shape our democracy.
Absolutely. I mean, I am interested to see what the fallout is from this, given that much of the Democratic leadership that Clyburn hit, the whole team that he was a part of, I mean, he was the number three to Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi. You know, they're on the outs at this point, and that they're beginning to cede power, at least in, we hope. Although their influence is still very great, it's going to be interesting to see that generational divide play out as you describe.
Yeah, I'm going to be watching it very closely. And one of the things that I'm trying to do in my reporting is look at redistricting more broadly. You know, everybody agrees this is one of the critical threats to democracy. Like the fact that state legislatures can determine who's going to sit in Congress, and that we just saw an election in the last cycle where gerrymandering in different states played a critical role in giving Republicans a very slender majority. And so I'm trying as a reporter to kind of get to the root of that. You know, what is happening? And it's hard because the Clyburn story, as you may have detected, required a lot of reporting in the court record and interviewing dozens of people in the state to get a feel of how that worked.
Right. Lastly, is this, in your opinion, more indicative of Southern Black Democrats' alliance with Republicans in their state than, I guess, are there other examples of this that are eventually kind of going to get uncovered where Democrats are kind of okay with their seat being so heavily gerrymandered, even if Black voters in these red states are not represented as broadly as they should be?
I think it is playing out in a number of Southern states, and it's playing out not just at the congressional level, but at the legislative level. The South Carolina legislature, you know, also went through a gerrymandered process for its redistricting, and a number of elected Black officials lost their seats because Republicans in the back rooms figured out a way to draw the district so that they wouldn't be elected. And so it's a hot issue. And I do believe that, especially if journalists begin probing the details of what's going on in the horse trading, who's doing what, we are going to see more examples.
Well, thanks so much for your reporting on this. It's really excellent work. I mean, ProPublica, you guys just doing incredible work over there between this and the Clarence Thomas story.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your work. Marilyn Thompson, you can check out the pieces that she's written about Jim Clyburn in the description below. We'll link to both of them. And wherever you're listening to this, it should be there. Thank you so much, Marilyn.
Thank you.
All right, guys, with that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program and head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. That is the number. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Oh, yeah, Left Reckoning. We had Vivek Chibber and Matt Huber on to talk about class, climate, the labor aristocracy of the West, different things like that. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get access to the postgame. David and I will be discussing some more stuff for the Sunday show. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
And on ESPN, we didn't have an episode last week. Sorry about that. But we will be coming back big time. We're going to talk about the developments in the NHL NBA playoffs. I mean, is there anyone having a better playoffs than Jimmy Butler is my question to you, besides Jokic?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is maybe Jokic.
I mean, man, that was an incredible performance last night. And we'll be speaking about that. The Arizona Coyotes losing their bid to stay there, not a referendum voting down their stadium. Praise be. And more things. We'll talk about that on Monday. Sorry, we're behind on an episode, guys. But for now, let's just check out Doom, check out Scam Economy, check out the discourse. We'll head into the fun half, and then they'll talk about what they're doing over there on their shows. As always, please become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Support this show. We're able to speak to all these experts, historians, journalists because of you. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And then you can IM the show, and I can read them. So, all right, guys, heading into the fun half. See you there. You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.